For 2 days, the blockade was maintained. By the third, Cleomenes, hungry, filthy, and stubble-chinned, had had enough. A truce was arranged. The Spartans, humiliatingly, were obliged to accept safe conduct to the border. Isagoras managed to slip away into exile. His fellow collaborators, meanwhile, were rounded up and put to death. Democracy, having staked its future amid the smoke and bloodshed of revolution, had endured the first attempt to snuff it out. Cleisthenes promptly hurried back in triumph. The victory, however, as everyone knew, was hardly his alone. But even his most die-hard opponents now had to accept that there could be no retreating from the reform program he had promised the Athenian people. Indeed, with the lynching of Isagoras's followers still fresh in everybody's mind, it had become possible even for the upper classes to feel a certain sense of relief that Cleisthenes was back. Better him and his carefully planned package of reforms than blood flowing in the streets, and Eupatrid corpses strung up on the Acropolis, rotting in the heat. So it was that midway through that momentous year of 507 BC, an Alcmaeonid relative of Cleisthenes was able to take over smoothly from Isagoras as Archon and resume the transformation of Athens into a state like no other in history. While eunomia, good governance, had been the watchword of previous Greek reformers, that of Cleisthenes and his associates was subtly and yet radically different. Isonomia, equality. Equality before the law, equality of participation in the running of the state. This, henceforward, was to be the Athenian ideal. True, some citizens remained much more equal than others. It remained the case, for instance, that only the upper classes could run for high office. But Athens had become a city in which any citizen, no matter how poor or uneducated, was guaranteed freedom of public speech, in which policy was no longer debated in the closed and gilded salons of the aristocracy, but openly in the assembly. No measure could be adopted, no law passed, save by the votes of all the Athenian people. This was a state in which, for the first time, a citizen could feel himself both engaged and in control. Nothing in Athens, or indeed Greece, would ever quite be the same again. And that, for Cleisthenes and all who supported him, was absolutely the point. The sponsors of the Athenian Revolution were no giddy visionaries moved by shimmering notions of brotherhood with the poor, but rather hard-nosed pragmatists whose goal, quite simply, was to profit as Athenian noblemen by making their city strong. To this ambition, and to the whole immense project that followed from it, they brought a desperate energy. Time, as they well knew, was hardly on their side. It was not only that Cleomenes, who felt that the Athenians had shown him disrespect in word and deed, was set on revenge. Cleisthenes also feared, with both Hippias and Isagoras plotting their returns, that the city might implode at any moment into rival factions. Dynastic feuding, having brought Athens to the point of ruin, was simply too lethal to be tolerated any further, an analysis which even the dynasties themselves appeared reluctantly now to have accepted. Cleisthenes' solution was both brilliantly simple and quite ferociously ambitious. To suppress a citizen's identification with family, neighbourhood, and local clan chief altogether. Cleisthenes sliced up the countryside into almost 150 separate districts. It was from these, the demes, and no longer from their families, that the citizens of the new democracy would henceforward be obliged to take their second names. Their civic identity, too. For a young man, when he came of age, might become a citizen of Athens under Cleisthenes' reforms only by being enrolled within a deme. The haughtiest Eupatrid and the humblest ploughman as fellow demesmen would share the same second name. Not all Eupatrids were thrilled by this innovation, of course. Still, they had to be careful. Cleisthenes, with his customary preemptive cunning, had ordained that demesmen should select delegates from among themselves to travel to Athens and there prepare the agenda for the assembly. What aristocrat worth his salt was going to put snobbery above such a plum opportunity? Just as Cleisthenes had to encourage the Eupatrids not to sulk in their tents, so he had to beware a counter-danger, that an ambitious nobleman might use his deme as a springboard to tyranny. Against that peril, deploying both their habitual foresight and their fiendish taste for complicating anything they touched, the founders of the democracy massed a whole array of checks and balances. Demes were bunched into thirds. A third, as the name implied, was then grouped with two others to form a tribe. The thirds would all be drawn from separate corners of Attica to snarl up ancient roots. In place of the primal simplicities of the clan, the Athenian people could now enjoy infinitely more artificial and finely calibrated loyalties. Tribes, thirds, and demes. Here were complexities not easily manipulable by even the best connected aristocrats. But could they be made to work?